Okie dokie. This is our final official lecture for exploration.
Okay.
And the thought was that I would do a rip through what we learnt in exploration in the hopes of giving you guys a bit of an edge in the final. And then I would talk about anything that anybody had concerns on. And then I would go back to trying to figure and get more of the workstations on the remote bundle working. Because at the moment, when you turn on all six workstations, a random four of them come online, and we don't know why. So we're working on remedying that. And that will involve getting some PCI serial cards and a whole lot of messing around that we hope will stabilize it. But we're hoping that there'll be enough workstations online for you guys to be able to do your labs. We have actually succeeded in correcting the cabling that had some interesting things done to it. So now you can actually ping the routers from the workstations, which is a good start.
Be hard to do a lab on pinging if you couldn't ping the routers from the workstations.
Well, yes, we realise that. Although that's not until Chapter 5 that you actually have to ping, so there's still a few labs you can get by without having to ping. But we have actually fixed that. There were some odd cables running to odd places, and we managed to correct that, and we believe that the physical side of things should now be all good. The rack was recabled, and the people that recabled it weren't quite as accurate as we would have liked.
They keep telling us at my school, 90% of all network problems are physical.
It is. This is very true. A lot of them are generally down to the physical layer. Okay, now has anybody apart from Robert been into the remote bundle since last week?
I've gone out in here and there.
Well, on the bright side, workstations 1 and 2 are both working now. Okay, so worst case scenario, you've now got workstations 1 and 2, and you've got router 1, and you've got switch 1, and all of that is functional. So I'm not going to touch that, and you guys will have that to have a mess around with, and I will work on getting the other stuff up and running later today temporarily. Although when the bundle loses power, we will have to go through the same procedure to get it back up again, and because we're running probably about 20 amps worth of gear, we're not going to be able to UPS the bundle.
Hope you got good backups of all those files and setting files or whatever you have to set up in there.
Oh, yes. We're using a thing called rsnapshot, which, if you haven't heard of it, uses a combination of rsync, Perl, and hardlinks to maintain a Time Machine-like backup, which involves hourly, well, they're every 4 hours, daily, weekly, and monthly snapshots across two different hard drives in a particular server, as well as a backup at home of all of the data on the server, and that includes the virtual machines. So, yes, we have backups.
I'm a bit hesitant in using the remote bundle in with the labs and making sure I'm doing the right thing. Do you actually want us to go in on one of the labs that says to install Thunderbird onto the remote bundle?
No. You've got it. There's actually, that lab is actually broken into three different portions. Okay, so if you were on an actual bundle, there's option 1, option 2, and option 3. So what you do is you pick the option that is specific to your situation. So for example, with the Apache web server lab, if you want to install Apache onto your local computer, and you may not want to, but if you do, you pick the option that says install it to your local workstation. If you want to work on the remote bundle, then you use the copies of Apache on the remote bundle. Now, when it comes to the Thunderbird lab, you do actually use a copy of MUT to actually send and receive the mail, so you shouldn't need to install anything anywhere. So just follow the numbers, and where it says option 1, option 2, option 3, just make sure you're doing option 3 all the way through, or option 1 all the way through, or whichever one you've picked, because I've actually given you three options in case you did happen to be on the Cisco lab topology, which you're obviously not, but that was what the original lab was written for.
Is MUT spelled M-U-T-T or M-U-T?
M-U-T-T, as in a mangy mutt.
Thank you.
And it's okay if things die. There's a couple of keystrokes you need to know about. One of them is Control-C. That is a good one. That will tend to break out of certain things in Unix if you find yourself in in a telnet or something that you need to break out of, and it looks as though you're typing stuff in and it's still not doing good things. And then the next command is Control D, which will log you out and get you out of shells and stuff. We've covered that previously. That will allow you to log out of the workstations rather than just disconnecting, because I've noticed that when I've connected into the serial switch, some people have left login sessions open, which isn't a huge problem. It just means that you didn't log out when you were done. And control backslash is the other one that kills things. And it basically has a bigger go at actually killing the process. So if you're stuck in something that you don't know how to get out of, often control backslash will kill it and get you back to a shell prompt, and people will be a lot happier. Also keep in mind that I'm probably going to be fairly lenient with the marking on these labs. If you've actually gone in and given it a go and actually achieved a few of the results, you're likely to get your lab marks. I'm not expecting everybody to be able to 100% perfectly complete their labs, but if by looking at the labs I can see that you've gone in and had a shot at it and got a couple of things to work, we can actually give you the mark for those labs. I mean, ultimately we'd like to see all of the people do all of the labs, but we will take various degrees of that. Oh, the other good news is that there is potentially work in progress, and I underline the word potential, for a Linux course second semester next year. So if people could spread the word, and we could see how many people would be interested in that, that might make that a reality second semester, actually doing a Linux course. Okay, so shall we do a quick recap of Exploration 1, and then, or has anybody got any questions they want to raise before we go on and do that? The other thing you can also keep in mind is that if you really get stuck with the remote bundle, you can organise a time for me to jump on Skype with you and give you a hand, if that's something you want to do. We are in here Wednesday, Thursday and Friday, although as of next week, ITE1 will be taking over our Wednesday time slot. However, I am available on Skype, and I am actually able to help people through bits and pieces on the remote bundle, especially if you're not particularly confident with Linux. I can certainly organise something there to help you get a bit used to the interface. Okay, anybody got any outstanding pending questions before I go through and do an extremely quick rundown on Exploration 1? The course is open until the 31st of January at this stage. You can take the final any time between now and then. However, the final can only be active for an 8-hour time window. And we usually sit around on Ventrilo with you in case you've got any questions for the final, because it's obviously a fairly big test. Although if that's not possible or it doesn't line up with your time zones, we do let you go and do the final yourself. But we do try and be around for you in case you do have issues you need to raise, which obviously don't include the answer to the questions, but they can occasionally include a few hints. I'm not sure how many people have done, I haven't looked in the gradebook recently, but there are a couple of modules. It doesn't look like a lot of people have done a lot of the chapter tests. You get a number of shots at the chapter tests, so guys, feel free to go through and have a shot at the chapter tests. It will show you what you do and what you don't know, and then if you want, I can go through with the answers with you and talk you through the questions that weren't correct. And hopefully that will help when you do the test again after that. You guys all looking forward to Thanksgiving tomorrow? Or is that today?
2 days.
Well, actually, it's Tuesday here in the U.S., so it'll be on Thursday. Does Australia have something equivalent to Thanksgiving?
Oh, no. We don't have that sort of history. From what I remember, we weren't very nice to the people that were here before us, and we don't have that sort of institution. But we have Christmas, but we don't have the Thanksgiving thing, and you don't get a lot of turkey over here.
Well, I suppose you could always stuff an emu.
No, they're an endangered species. You're not allowed to. You can eat kangaroo, but we've got lots of chicken over here. But no, you can't do an emu. They're a bit tough, actually, emus. Their eggs are really good, but you're not allowed to eat those either. Can you buy farmed emu, can you? Oh, okay. Oh, right. Oh. Yeah, apparently it's not very nice, but you can buy it. So, okay. Anyway, back to course content. Okay, exploration was basically an overview of an introduction to networking. We talked about the 7-layer OSI reference model. Let's see if collectively we can get through all of the layers. Can anybody give me one of the layers starting at the bottom?
Physical.
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 Okay, yep, we have three people with physical, which is excellent. And the physical layer is responsible for the wiring and the bits and bytes and or the actual electrical voltages that go over the wires. So that's the physical layer. Okay, so that's layer one. Okay, anybody tell me the next layer up?
Data link.
Data link.
Data link. Yep, anybody want to have a go at telling me what the data link layer does? And if nobody knows, I'll tell you, but
it's basically putting all the packets into frames.
That's one of the things it does. It certainly, well, the protocol data unit for the data link layer is in fact the frame. But one of the things that the data link layer concerns itself is with the signaling method, whether you're dealing with CSMACD or CSMACA or token ring and that sort of thing. It also handles frame check sequences for your frames, so it handles error detection. And it also handles, in certain cases, the retransmission of packets, frames, I should say. We are working at frames at this layer of the OSI reference model. We usually consider that Ethernet runs at this level, point-to-point protocol, stuff over serial lines tends to run at this level. So it's below things like IP and those sorts of things. Okay, next layer up.
Okay. Network.
Anybody want to have a go at what the network layer does? I promise I won't take marks off if people get it wrong.
Well, the network layer does packets, and it's deals with the addresses, getting all the addresses whether the way they're supposed to be.
Deals with the logical addresses. And I should have mentioned that the data link layer deals with the physical addresses, such as the media access control address, which are the ones that are burnt into the EEPROM of your Ethernet card. However, the network layer is concerned with logical addresses, which are the addresses that are set by the network administrator, or theoretically set by the network administrator, which is theoretically you. And it concerns itself with how those addresses are assigned and how those addresses are used and how those devices are addressed at the logical layer. Are people still having trouble with the big overall picture of the OSI reference model? Or is it just a lot of stuff and everybody's just finding it lots of stuff?
Mostly it's a lot of stuff, and it's always seemed, I mean, it's not the first time I've encountered it, and it seems a bit theoretical. I mean, I get why it's important, but it does seem a bit sort of theoretical, and in the real world doesn't tend to be separated out like that.
Well, it kind of does. It depends on who you talk to. You do tend to see a lot of Cisco technicians sort of wandering around going, oh, yeah, that's a layer 4 problem. Yeah, it's definitely a layer 4 problem. I mean, so I think it depends on, you know, what sort of technicians and stuff you're working with. The reason for the OSI reference model is that in a lot of installations, you're dealing with more protocols than just TCP/IP. So if you're dealing with things like wireless networks, fiber networks, and you're dealing with the stuff that's below or is part of the network access layer, that's when the OSI reference model can be important. The other thing to keep in mind is that the OSI reference model gives you a structured way of working through the troubleshooting process. For people who don't have a lot of experience, so you can catch a couple of Zeds here, Brian, with this stuff, a lot of people get stuck with where do I start? I've got a problem and I have no idea what to look at. And there are basically three ways of solving problems with the OSI reference model. You can work from the bottom up, so you can check your physical, you can check your data link, you can check your network, and yes, we will do all of the other layers in a minute. Or you can work from the top down, which is where you look at your application, etc., layers, and work down. And then there's another one called divide and conquer, which is used by experienced technicians, where you start in the middle, around about the transport layer, and if there's a couple of you, one works up and the other one works down, and you isolate the problem that way. Now, I realize as an experienced technician, you just tend to look at what stuff went wrong, and then you've got a pretty good gut feeling as to, based on what stuff went wrong, what do I need to do to rectify that problem. But if the problem is really bizarre, odd, or unusual, it can actually pay to work on that OSI reference model basis so that you can actually narrow things down. Is it a cable problem? Is it a packet retransmission problem? Is it an IP address problem? That sort of stuff. Does that make any sense?
It absolutely does. I'm just trying to work out sort of, let's say, a real-world example of troubleshooting a data link issue.
Okay, say for example you've got a lab full of workstation, or okay, so you've got an office with five computers in it and the network is going really, really slow on a 100 megabit switch. It's, you know, it's taking, you know, 2 minutes to save a 100K docs file to the file server. You might, for example, actually this is physical, but you may, for example, then need to get somebody to check things like lights on the network cards and stuff, and you might find that the network card in workstation number 4 has got a jabbering transceiver, and as a result of it having a jabbering transceiver, you are actually seeing greatly reduced network card performance. In other words, if you unplug workstation number 4, everything starts going fast again. And you can look for that sort of stuff with Wireshark or TCP dump to see it at the data link layer as well as looking at it at the physical layer. Well, that's one example. I only had 5 seconds to come up with it. I might see if I can come up with another one, but there's one anyway. Has anybody ever seen that? I have once, where the whole network performance just dropped away to nothing and you track it down to one network interface card in one particular recalcitrant workstation.
I have seen it with one workstation slowing everything down, but it actually wasn't a network, a physical issue so much as a layer 3 issue. For some reason, the TCP/IP was screwed up. I actually think it got in. There was some kind of malware, and it was sending out huge amounts of data.
Yeah, that's another good one, actually, because we actually had a situation where the network performance was really low, and when we actually opened up the web interface of the router and had a look at the open network address translation connections, there was like 1,000 connections open from the inside to the outside of the network, and no, nobody was running BitTorrent, okay, so we can't blame them for that. This was an office where nobody ran BitTorrent, or LimeWire, or those sorts of things. And we actually discovered that, yeah, it was actually malware that was initiating all of these SMTP connections from all of the workstations, and it was basically, given about 5 to 10 minutes, it would actually crash the router. So the router would latch up and stop responding, and it wasn't until we cleaned up the workstations that we actually found that that problem went away. The other one that would be a data link layer, actually, now that I think about it, would be that MTU issue, where SSH works and the big web pages don't load. That's a data link issue. It's an odd one, but it is basically at the data link. When you look at the MTU is in the TCP/IP protocol stack, but it does actually relate to the actual packet size that's going across the network.
Yeah, and I've actually encountered that one when I first got DSL. There was none of this automatic setting. You had to do it all by hand. And I had exactly that problem, and it took me quite a while to figure it out. But you're right. I mean, that's adjusting packet sizes, frames.
Yeah, you can either clamp the MSS, which is a maximum segment size for TCP, or you can limit the MTU to 1492 or whatever, which has nothing to do with Columbus sailing the seas of blue. It just happens to be 1500 minus 8, which is the overhead for the point-to-point over Ethernet packets. Okay, anybody tell me what layer 4 is on the... Oh, it's our reference model. And we could stop going through this... Thank you, Robert. And we can stop going through this at any time if you guys are bored, but it just seems as though everybody needs a revision.
No, I think it's worth doing. Well, I do anyway.
Okay. Transport layer. Anybody want to have a go at telling me what the transport layer is essentially responsible for and which popular three-character protocol does a lot of its work at the transport layer?
It's the TCP protocol.
Okay, you can have half a jelly bean.
End-to-end transfer of data.
Yeah, it transfers data. Yes, it's responsible for transferring, usually it's segments at the transport layer, segments of data in the TCP protocol. The transport layer concerns itself with data retransmission, and it concerns itself with reliable end-to-end data delivery. So that's what happens at the transport layer, essentially. Okie dokie. We've had some odd network problems in the past where DNS and stuff, which is UDP-based, which is user datagram protocol as we discussed, would work fine. And then you open a couple of TCP connections and the underlying network link was so unstable that it couldn't handle sustained data transfer through with TCP. And you could argue that that was somewhat of a transport layer problem. There may have been other problems further down the stack that were causing it, but that would certainly point to a problem somewhere along there. And in fact, if you've got small UDP packets, like DNS packets, they're probably likely to make it through a mismatched MTU, whereas the full-size TCP packets full of www.facebook.com fun may not. So that's certainly a problem there. Okay, next, layer up the OSI reference model.
Session.
Okay. The protocols are now in session. What does the session layer, anybody can answer this, usually concern itself with?
Opening connections on the various ports and ensuring that those sort of sessions open and close properly.
Yeah, absolutely. That's exactly what happens. You do your little three-way handshake thing, and you open the source address, source port, destination address, destination port, which gives you a socket pair, and that allows you to talk to the web server or talk to the mail server or talk over your telnet connection or retrieve more tweets on Twitter and all those sorts of good things. So that's what the session layer is responsible for. And when you are using a network address translating device, such as a home DSL modem or other similar connectivity technology, you are looking at the modem keeping track of what sessions are open between the computers that are behind the network address translator and whatever people happen to be visiting, such as Facebook, Twitter, Google, YouTube, whatever. Okay, layer number 6.
Presentation.
Yes, we're throwing pizza at this point. Presentation. It's not the pizza layer, unfortunately. It's a presentation layer. And we had please do not throw sausage pizza away. Or all people seem to need data processing, but that seems to be written by network engineers that just want to keep their jobs, if you ask me. A presentation concerns itself with... Anybody tell me what presentation concerns itself with? Apart from putting on a tie and making sure your hair's combed and all that sort of thing?
I always had trouble distinguishing this from application because it's sort of... The two seem a bit intertwined because I think of presentation as sort of almost the end-user interface to the network, whether it's a telnet app or a web browser or a mail client or Twitter or whatever. I tend to think of that as presentation. I realize that's application, but I have trouble distinguishing the two.
Okay, if you consider... I have no idea why Gemma's on here, but she'll tell me in a minute if she comes down. if you look at the presentation layer, it generally tends to concern itself with character set conversion, encoding and decoding of various characters. So if you're working with an IBM mainframe, we're looking at things like ASCII to EBCDIC conversion. People are probably aware that when you attach the picture of your cute kitten, because who knows what the internet would do without thousands of pictures of cats. Sorry, it's one of my little bugbears. Why do we have to have pictures of cats doing everything on the internet? Sites such as lolcats.com, etc., which are devoted to such things. When you get the little picture of your cute kitty cat, it's actually Base64 encoded. Now, does anybody know how that works? You're not going to fail the course if you don't, but does anybody have any idea how Base64 encoding works?
Not really. I've heard of it, but I don't remember the theory behind it.
Wow, it's all happening this morning. Okay, yeah, they're doing exam supervision. It's all good. Okay. Base64 encoding. When you want to send binary data over email systems, generally speaking, email systems are not 8-bit clean. That's to say that all the characters between 0 and 255 aren't going to make it through the email system unmolested. They basically take the 8-bit stuff and they encode it into a printable form. Now, there are two forms of encoding that are commonly used. One of them is called UU encode, which uses the characters between 32 and 126. And the other one is called Base64. And it uses the characters a capital A to Z, lowercase a to Z, 0 to 9, and plus and minus. So 64 characters out of the set. Does anybody, as a matter of interest, know why UU encode used to be so problematic for sending binary data through email? I wouldn't expect anybody to know, but I'll ask anyway.
It's an entirely wild guess, but what the hell, we'll go for it. In the days of modems, you had specific characters, i.e. control X and things, that did things to your modem. And if those were part of your transmission, nasty things would happen, like it would drop your connection.
That's partially true. That is certainly a concern, and obviously the control characters wouldn't make it through. But the other problem, of course, was that when you did an ASCII to EBCDIC character conversion, you would actually destroy the UU encoding. So if you sent stuff to an IBM mainframe running EBCDIC, and it was UU encoded, it would actually get messed up. Now, the other thing you've got to keep in mind about, and a lot of people don't realize this, but a lot of things you've got to keep in mind about Base64 encoding, because Base64 encoding uses, it splits things into printable characters and only uses 64 characters to do it, and it's doing it with bytes, it actually expands your file by 25%. So when you attach a file to email, it's actually going to get 25% bigger than what it was on your disk, and then when it's decoded at the other end, it will lose its 25% and go back to the original size, which is why it's more efficient to use Dropbox or Skype transfer or Windows Messenger file transfer or a website or FTP than it is to actually attach things to email. So that's somewhat interesting. Okay, but the presentation layer is responsible for character set conversion. It's responsible for, occasionally it can be responsible for the translation of different character sets to work on different systems. So it's not exactly the application. It's responsible for things like character sets for, say, Chinese, for example, whether you're using traditional Chinese or whatever. If you're doing Japanese, whether you're using kanji, what encoding of the kanji you're going to use, all of those sorts of things. And the final layer, which I think we all know what it is by now, but anybody want to tell me what the final layer is?
Applications.
It is the application layer. And the application layer is the layer that the application talks to, which is before the stuff actually gets into the data transport system. Okay, anybody got any questions on all that? Okay, no worries. Okie dokie. And there are some questions in the test that do concern themselves with the ISI reference model. So it pays to have a bit of an overview as to what each of the specific layers does. Not in horrendous detail, but you should know what order they go in and what are the different protocol data units for each layer. So at the application layer, we have data. At the transport layer, we have segments. At the network layer, we have packets. At the data link layer, we have frames. And at the physical layer, we have bits. Okay, now, the other things we basically talked about in exploration was we talked about the different media types. We talked about copper cable, we talked about unshielded twisted pair, we talked about shielded twisted pair, we talked about twisted pair having four twisted pairs of wires. Anybody tell me the maximum length for a single run of twisted pair cabling between two switches or similar?
100 meters.
Or do you happen to know the old school measurement for it?
About 280 feet.
328 feet. That's okay. It's 100 meters or 328 feet.
And you have a bit of leeway if you got really clean cable and not too much EMI. You can run it out a hair longer, but you are asking for trouble.
Yeah, and there are devices that will clean up signals and extend cable lengths and do all sorts of things that violate the specs. Those sorts of things are certainly a challenge. Okay, the other things we talked about were basically the carrier sense multiple access with collision detection function of Ethernet, where it listens for silence. It then tries to transmit a signal. If it detects a collision, it will back off a random amount of time and then try to retransmit the packet after that back off time. It also tends to... we also spoke about TCP, UDP. We spoke about the packet numbers. UDP being a fire-and-forget mechanism with no confirmations unless the high-level protocols do that, and TCP being your reliable end-to-end data transfer. We spoke about cabling conduits. We spoke about safety requirements for dealing with various cables as to whether you wear safety goggles if dealing with optical fiber or various other things such as wearing gloves and stuff if dealing with sharp copper cable. Is there anything that is confusing anybody about the whole curriculum that they would like me to cover again? We did a hell of a lot on binary subnet conversion and subnetting and that sort of thing. And those will be emailed and marked and emailed back to you guys today, but it looks like everybody was doing a fairly good job of that conversion.
Ian did a little thing on transmission mechanisms, and I have to admit he'd lost me completely.
Sorry, Brian, I missed that. What did I lose you completely on?
No, it wasn't you. One of the weeks, Ian Murray actually came in and did a talk on transmission units, I think. I'm trying to remember the exact content because I remember it confusing me no end.
Where he did Manchester encoding and all that sort of stuff.
That was it.
Yeah, it's all right, they don't test you on it. The Manchester encoding was basically a discussion on how the signals were actually sent over the wire. And unless you're curious about the marriage certificate, not the marriage certificate, sorry, they're talking about it here in the background here. We've managed to leave one at home. Unless you're curious about the Manchester encoding, it's not going to be tested.
No, I can look it up. I wasn't sure if we're going to be tested on that. I was very worried.
No, we're not testing you on the Manchester at all. You don't need to know. I did it purely for the curious and for Pranav to know about it. And also because we usually do a small segment on it just so that people have some idea that these encodings go into place in that way. Alrighty. What I would suggest people revising the material, read through all the chapter summaries and see if any of it confuses you. and then go back and read the sections that confuse you once you've read the chapter summaries. That's usually how I do it, because the chapter summaries have got a good sort of rundown on the stuff, and then you can sort of go, ooh, I don't remember what they meant by single and multi-mode fiber, and then you can jump back and read those particular sections to brush yourself up on it. I've got to check whether there's a practice final. If there is a practice final, I will activate it for you all, and you can all have a shot at that so you've got some idea as to what's going on in the actual final. All right, any questions before we end lecture for today? All right, have fun, guys. Keep in touch. If you guys don't do your final before the 31st of January, you don't pass. So make sure you keep in touch with us one way or the other, and we'll make sure that happens, and we will also make sure that people who need help with their labs and stuff get in touch with me on Skype. I will be sitting in here. That's what they pay me to do, and I can give some of you a hand with that stuff if you're having trouble with it, and we will be finishing off the rest of those labs fairly soon, rewriting those and getting you guys to do as many of them as possible. There is also, and I wouldn't necessarily recommend everybody go and do this, but apparently there is a $99 course you can do on driving Wireshark from the command line. It's something that I personally will be interested in looking in to, but it may be useful given Wireshark's limited accessibility at the moment on the GUI. All right, guys, enjoy Thanksgiving, and if anybody has any questions, email me, Skype me, whatever.
Thanks, Kerry. We had a really good time at this week. So far, I really enjoyed it and learned a whole lot.
Oh, that's good. That's good. And we, as I said, we'll be around. But do keep in touch with us, and we'll continue to help you guys all the way through to the end, because we'd like to see as many of you as possible pass.